So today we're going to finish this series called Into the Mystic. And we have been in the Gospel of John for a while, and we've been looking at some of the symbolism that's in the Gospel of John. Symbolism is around us all the time. It might not register to us as a symbol that communicates a deeper meaning, but it is there all the time, and it usually comes from the pens of poets and the songs of musicians. It helps us sit up and to take notice of things maybe that we have not taken the time to think about. So sometimes those images carry a long time. I want to show you an album cover, and this album cover goes all the way back to 1971. This album cover is the title of the song American Pie. Anybody familiar with it? Okay. Now, it is a song that transcends generations. If you look on YouTube, Garth Brooks, in a concert that he's doing in Central Park, sings this song, and he says this is probably one of the greatest songs that was ever written. You might agree, you might not agree. How many of you have heard that song and you say, what is he talking about? There's a lot of imagery in that particular song. So Don McLean, when he was a boy, had a severe case of asthma. And he was not allowed to go outside and to participate in some of the sports and stuff that other kids normally did. So he kind of holed up in his bedroom. It was there that he fell in love with music. And it was at that time in his life when there was a trio of musicians that caught his ear. One of them was Buddy Holly. The other was Richie Valens. And the third one was a nickname, Big Bopper Richardson. These were all very young men that was just starting the wake of rock and roll and moving into the era of the 60s. They did a concert out in Iowa, and they needed to get to their next gig in Minnesota, and they climbed aboard a small airplane, and the weather wasn't very favorable, and that plane crashed in Iowa, and they all died. And so that was something that was very significant to Don McLean, and he calls that day that these three young musicians died the day that music died, which is one of the lines in the song. And he takes it from there, and he spends a number of months contemplating this significant event, and he begins to write down some lyrics, and then he writes down a chorus. And he took months to try to put this song together. And after he did, he took this song forward into the 60s. And for those of you who lived during that era of time, you know it was a turbulent time, a very turbulent time in the life of our nation. And so many of the lyrics in the song American Pie are reminiscing about the events. So when you hear things like this, when he says, a long, long time ago, I can still remember how the music used to make me smile. And I knew if I had my chance, I could make those people dance because he wanted to learn music, right? And maybe they'd be happy for a while. And then he says, but February, which is the day that the plane crashed, made me shiver with every paper I deliver. He was a paper boy. But bad news on the doorstep, I could not take one more step. I can't remember if I cried when I read about his widowed bride, but something touched me deep inside the day the music died. Okay, it's a song about him remembering this trio of musicians. But listen to this now. He says, bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry, and them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, this'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die. And as he goes into this, he then begins to talk a little bit about the life that he wished he had. I was a lonely teenage bronc and buck with a pink carnation and a pickup truck, but I knew I was out of luck the day the music died. And then he goes on, he says, now for 10 years, we've been on our own, and moss grows fat on a rolling stone, but that's not how it used to be when the jester sang for the king and queen and a coat he borrowed from James Dean and a voice that came from you and me. Oh, and while the king was looking down, the jester stole his thorny crown. The courtroom was adjourned. No verdict was returned. And while Lennon read a book on Marx, a quartet practiced in the park, and we sang dirges in the dark the day the music died. He's interplaying this personal experience with a kind of community experience that's going on in the 60s as well. And so the symbolism is personal, but it takes on a public nature. Are you following what I'm saying? So when you think about something like this, the reason this song became legendary is it told a collective story. The day the music died was a personal story. But what about if that same idea or song was written today? Maybe the American Pie ballad of tomorrow might be entitled The Day Democracy Died, The Day the Planet Died, The Day that Racism Died, The Day that Scapegoating Died, The Day that White Nationalism Died, The Day that Corporate Rule Died, The Day that Hatred Died. It becomes kind of a public community wish. Now, the reason I understand what he was talking about is if any of you have Paramount app on your TV, you can watch this movie. It's an hour and a half long about one song. It's called The Day the Music Died. And he goes through every line and talks about the symbolism behind all the words. And it's very influential, and it's very instructional, and it's very inspiring all at the same time. Now, why am I bringing this up? What he did with one song is what John is doing with his whole gospel. He's reminiscing about the life and ministry of Jesus, but he arranges it in such a way that it communicates a bigger message just than looking back on the life of Christ. It's a message to the community. It's a message to John's followers that he is trying to pastor. So in this message that is being communicated in the Gospel of John, we've gone through this long outline where I took another song, Into the Mystic, to envision a man trying to get home safely to shore. There is this idea of mankind that is traveling the stormy waters and trying to get back to God. And what we find in the Gospel of John is this symbolism that involves seven statements from Jesus, seven lights along the shoreline, and all these different characters that are spotlighted in the book, and these conversations that Jesus has with these different characters. Then now we see post-resurrection that not only do individuals arrive safely on the shore, but mankind can arrive safely at shore as well. These things are written, Paul says at the end of chapter, John says at the end of chapter 20, these things are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing, you might have life in his name. That's his purpose statement. So he uses all these images, including light, but probably one of the biggest ones is these encounters. And we talked a little bit about mysticism being those mysterious moments, whether it's an encounter or experience or event, that creates a memory or meaning or movement that transcend time. And that's what happened to Don McLean at a moment in time in his growing up years. Well, what we find for us is that in these statements, there's something to feed upon. The one who is the bread of life, light of the world, the gate for the sheep, the good shepherd, resurrection and life, way, truth, and life, and the true vine. And what we find is in these seven miracles, changing the water to wine, healing the royal official's son, the paralytic, feeding the multitude, walking on water, healing the man blind from birth, and raising Lazarus from the dead, all these things are brought together for this, to continue to pursue justice, love, spirituality, beauty, freedom, truth, and power with Christ. So today we come to Peter. And I read that whole chapter for you a moment ago. And that passage is for all the disciples, but it's in particular focused upon Peter at the very end. You know, I like this idea of symbolism because it communicates in a powerful way. I came across this quote by Catholic theologian John Dominic Crozan. He says, "It's not that those ancient people told literal stories and now we're smart enough to take them symbolically, but that they told them symbolically and we are dumb enough to take them literally." There's something that it communicates. So that begs this question. What are we learning in these Easter accounts? There's four episodes, Mary Magdalene, the disciples, Thomas, and Peter. What are they communicating to us? And it all comes to a head in chapter 21. But this was not included in the original gospel. The gospel ended at the end of chapter 20, and later redactors added this story in chapter 21. And the key question is why? Why would this be added later? And why is it probably not from the pen of the Apostle John? And here's a few reasons. It seems to be added later because it's a symbolic exploration of what the resurrection experience produced in the life of John's community. John, who eventually is the pastor of the seven churches that are listed in the book of Revelation, he then is trying to encourage these people to endure what are the beginning stages of persecution. You know, John eventually was exiled to the island of Patmos, and if it is the same John that wrote the gospel as the book of Revelation, John is the revelator that is communicating how to survive the persecution of the early church, initially by Nero in 60 AD, but he is not the last one. This succession of Caesars all would kind of try to pin their problems upon Christians, and they would often be punished for it. Some of them would give their life for it. In fact, most of the disciples gave their life for it. Most all of them were martyred in various places throughout the Roman Empire. Well, what is chapter 21? Well, if you are looking at this as the capstone for what had come before, it's only natural that this redactor would add a water story to close it off. Why? Now, I have not told you why I chose that nautical theme 15 weeks ago, did I? Here's why. The theme of water is through the whole gospel. Take a look here. In chapters 1 and chapter 3, Jesus and John are baptized with water. Jesus changes water to wine. Jesus tells Nicodemus he must be born of water and the Spirit to see the kingdom of God. Jesus meets a Samaritan woman who asks for a drink of water, and then he offers her living water in the course of the conversation. Jesus heals an invalid. Where at? By the pool of Bethesda. Jesus walks on water. Jesus invites people to drink living water at the Feast of Tabernacles in chapter 7. He heals a man born blind, and he just doesn't say, "Oh, go on home." He says, "Go wash your eyes in the pool of Siloam," which is a word that means scent. Go to the pool of scent. Then Jesus washes the disciples' feet with water On the cross, Jesus cries out, "I am thirsty." Jesus reveals himself on a beach to seven disciples. Not all 12 are there at the beginning of chapter 21. And then finally, he sits beside the sea with Peter to tell Peter to tend the sheep. Water is a key theme in the book of John. And it plays out in a variety of different ways. And the first way it plays out in chapter 21 is we are told that the disciples, they go back to what they knew. So what do we do now? Jesus is dead. Yes, the tomb is empty, right? And yes, Jesus appeared to the disciples, and we saw that he shows himself to doubting Thomas. But in chapter 21, they go back to fishing. That's what they know. They don't know where they're to carry on this ministry of Jesus. And so they go back. They have to make a living. They got to make money to put bread on the table for their families. They still have boats. Most of the disciples were fishermen. So they go back and they go out in the middle of the night because that's when they would drop their nets. And the sun would come up and there was nothing in the net. And then they hear this voice along the shore, "Throw your net over to the other side of the boat." And all of a sudden, the story tells us there were 153 fish that were caught. And it was so heavy that they had trouble getting it to shore. Well, what we find is that John, the one that is portrayed as the disciple that Jesus loves, says, "It's the Lord. It's the Lord." So what does Peter do? He does what he always does. He jumps. He jumps at the opportunity, and he jumps into the water, and he swims to shore, and it's there he's going to meet Jesus along the shoreline. You know, these fishermen were lacking direction. All they knew was fishing. And when you're going through a time of grief, we all have a way of being stripped down to our basic survival skills, don't we? Well, they could have continued until this intervention when Jesus reveals himself to the disciples and he is showing them that their old way of life is an empty net. And he tells them to fish on the other side of the boat, and it's there they receive a big catch. All of this is symbolism. It's all communicating, don't go back to your previous life. That's not the way to go. You're not going to find what you found with me in those empty nets. But it comes to a wonderful, powerful point when he has this conversation with Peter along the shoreline. And this conversation has been immortalized, really, because Peter, who has been carrying a lot of guilt, right? He had betrayed the Lord three times. He was asked three times, "Aren't you a disciple of his?" As he is around what? A campfire. In the outer court where Jesus is being tried and condemned to death, and he says he's not a disciple of Jesus. He says he doesn't even know who Jesus is. And so around that campfire, he has betrayed the Lord. And all of a sudden here on the shore is this little campfire. And on the grill is some fish and some bread. And he gets to shore. And the other disciples are doing all the work of dragging all these fish in that they have just caught. But in the meantime, there's this conversation. And Jesus asks what I think Peter was afraid he asked. "Do you love me?" Because normally, most of us would say this, "Do you love me? If you love me, why did you betray me? If you love me, why did you deny who I was?" I think Peter probably was anticipating that that's the direction that this conversation was going to go. There's a powerful play of words in this section of John. There are several words for love in the Greek language. Agapao meaning unconditional love, phileo meaning friendship love, and then eros meaning a sexual or physical kind of love. Jesus says to Peter, "Do you agapao me? Do you unconditionally love me?" Peter goes, "You know that I do." Asks a second time, "Peter, do you agapao me? You know that I do." Then the third time, Jesus says, "Do you even phileo me?" Phileo, a word where we get the word Philadelphia, city of brotherly love. And by that time, Peter's heart is sinking. And he says, "God knows that I love you." But each time, Jesus would say, "Then tend my sheep, feed my sheep, tend my lambs." Don't go back to this old empty net. Come to the pasture land where other people, just like yourself, needed hope and forgiveness and love. This intimate conversation that Jesus has with Peter is one that is heartbreaking in one respect. But it is something that is encouraging symbolically, because there would be many Christians in the early first century period when persecution and problems would be thrust upon them that certainly would have recounted their love for Christ, because they want to save their job, they want to save their lives, they want to be able to continue to live. And so this message would hit home, wouldn't it? This message would hit home to say, "Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? If so, tend to my lambs. Care for one another. Watch over each other. Be the strength that is needed to continue. Well, Peter does something that's quite interesting. He hears this message from Jesus that it's going to cost him something. It would actually probably cost him his life. And Peter did what all of us would do. But what about him? What about him? And it seems as though he's pointing his finger to John. And he's saying, but what about him? Is he going to have to go through the same things that I'm going through? And Jesus says, don't worry about him. Just worry about yourself. In other words, stay in your own hula hoop, right? Don't get in someone else's hula hoop. You just follow me. And if I want him to remain, he'll remain. If I want him to take another path, that's what will happen. But the text tells us that they thought that John wouldn't have to die. Now, this is something that's very interesting. They developed a rumor that said, okay, Peter is going to have to give his life in service to Christ, but not John. And there's nothing of any certainty in that rumor. But that's what we tend to do, don't we? We tend to form an opinion, and then we tend to impose that opinion upon other people. Peter wants to know the outcome for John, and Jesus says, stay in your own hula hoop. You know, Peter then becomes not only a person that we can look to learn from, but he becomes a symbol. He becomes a symbol for all of us, especially for those of us who must believe without seeing. Remember when Thomas said, I won't believe unless I see the wound in his hand and in his side. And Jesus said, well, blessed are those who do not see and still believe. And I think that's the message of Peter, the one who is wrestling through this whole gospel. First, by pulling out his sword and trying to cut off the ear of a soldier in the garden of arrest. He's an individual that denies three times. You know what Peter is? He's me. He's me. Back and forth, up and down. All in, all out. And I think the appendix of the Gospel of John is to say, see, Peter, he's a symbol of all of us. He's a symbol of those of us who want to do what's right but don't have the strength to do it. He's the symbol of all of us who do wrong and then carry this guilt and this shame. He's the symbol of the early church and all the troubles that they will carry. But his is an encounter at the dawn of the Easter message. Remember, we said that Easter is not just a day in the calendar year, in the church calendar year. It's a period of time. It's Eastertide. It's a six-week period of time where we keep remembering what the life of Christ can do. And it is here during this Eastertide of our own calendar that we see Peter is able to come alive within the heart of God, because what awaits him? Love, acceptance, forgiveness, purpose. All these things are found in this term, tend my sheep, care for my lambs. So Peter saw in every moment there's a time to come alive in love, and so can we. Peter is an Easter person, as we are Easter people who become agents of giving love away, tend my lambs, care for my sheep. Love for others is always the best way to show love for God. Peter, do you love me? You know that I love you. Well, do you remember when I told you that I'm going to change your name, Peter, from Simon to Peter, which means the rock, and upon your confession, I will build my church? And Peter will become the instrumental apostle and considered within the Catholic faith to be the first pope. And what we find is that Peter is given a commission to continue to do what God calls all of us to do, to love beyond our boundaries, to care for people even when we'd rather not, to find the strength to take the next step, and at times to dive into the water because that's the best choice to make. You know, people are always more important than religious projects or even doctrinal proclamations. If a project or a proclamation takes the place of love, we're all off base. So love is always at the center. And what Easter is telling Peter and it's telling us is that the risen Christ is known when his disciples love as he loved. There's another element in this chapter, and that is he brings bread to this fire. To this campfire, he brings bread, and there's fish. And many scholars believe that this is kind of Eucharistic in nature, that is, the ongoing presentation of the bread and the cup, to be able to carry on the strength that is necessary for the work of Christ in the world. So that brings me back to the symbolism element. Just like Don McLean is talking for all of us, and in that show, The Day the Music Died, it shows young people that weren't even alive at the time that song was written, knowing it, right? Singing it in Central Park. Because it communicates something beyond the moment. And that's what John's gospel is doing, communicating something beyond the moment. So God is calling us to be incarnational people, making Christ known in the everyday opportunities that we have to tend other people's needs. I like what Parker Palmer, a writer, said one time, he says, it is amazing that a religion like Christianity, one that is supposed to be vested in the idea of incarnation, so often finds itself lost in disembodied concepts. Sometimes doctrine is more important than people. Sometimes projects are more important than people. And the most important thing that I think John is telling us is always keep people as number one. As we close off this series, I am reminded that God's love at times feels a little bit reckless. We're going to sing this song in a moment, but I think what's important for us is, why would God entrust something so important into the hands of Peter, who seems to be a little bit at times? Because that's the way all people are. We're strong and weak at the same time. We have clear eye and cloudy eye at the same time. We have pure motives and mixed motives all at the same time. And the core of this song that we'll close with is that God just keeps running after us. God keeps chasing us down. God keeps working within the moment that we find ourselves. God continues to call upon us to say, you know that I love you. Now help me to love you more. So as we gather here and close this series off, I trust that you'll go back to the Gospel of John and you'll reread it at times and look for the different symbols that are there, because it is a powerful piece of literature. It is a powerful revelation of who God is, who Christ is, and who we are.